Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Wesley Salmon.
It's a weird emphasis on the Wesley today.
Wow, I think middle names are underrated, so I like to endorse the usage of them.
Cool. It's a weird way to start the week, but whatever. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the real-life stripper heist Hustlers. Mm-hmm. That's the name of the movie. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including method acting. Joaquin Phoenix is making news again for his unconventional acting style. So is the method finally passé? Then, streaming is changing, and it seems like Disney is the one changing it. Disney Plus is releasing its shows week to week, or it will when it launches in November. Netflix is responding to make a similar change, so is this the end of binge watching as we know it? And then finally, James Cameron likes his chances at getting that box office crown back, but is Avatar going to be really that good? And maybe are we a little too worried about how much money movies make, and which movies make more money than other movies? We'll have that later in the show. For first, though, the Toronto International Film Festival is over for another week. Sorry about that. If you like lining up in downtown Toronto and all kinds of weather, waiting for rush tickets and other things.
You'll have to wait a bit for that,
entertainment. You can always wait till next week for the next film festival based in Toronto.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's, you know, nothing's quite like TIFF. Although, I mean...
TIFF's done.
Although that line waiting is that's part of the festival experience.
Yeah.
And like any good festival, that's like even Hot Docs. We do a lot of waiting in line in Hot Docs.
Yep. And all the blocked roads, not going to them, having to drive around extra hours. Now that's a classic film festival.
And that's needed. Yeah, that's a recent thing they've done in King Street, close King Street.
Yeah, it was like all of it.
4 days. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, worth it for the entertainment and just a film love. You get with TIFF.
Yeah. Speaking of film love, Jojo Rabbit, the Taika Waititi film, won the People's Choice Award, the coveted People's Choice Award, which is usually a prognosticator for, if not the Best Picture winner, definitely for a Best Picture nominee.
Mm-hmm.
So... do you think, I mean, realizing we haven't seen this,
I think it's a guarantee it's definitely going to get some awards, more major awards than this. I read the one article, it was Green Book. Mm-hmm. Green Book won People's Choice Award. Green Book won the Oscar. So,
yeah.
Even if it's just something more minor, like Best Director, Best Actor, I think it'll definitely win something. Worst come to worst, a Golden Globe win, I guess.
Fate worse than death at Golden Globe. No, yeah, you're right. It's
and it's new. It's new, so I think it deserves it as well.
Well, it's new, it's wacky, it's Taika Waititi who's weird to see how he's like blown up considering like how small like What We Do in the Shadows is and
how
for the Wilder People.
Where the Wild Things Are, Spike Jonze. It was not even an original concept based on a book.
No, Hunt for the Wilder People.
critical acclaim, got award noms, right? So if that one did, this one, 100%.
Yeah, no, the Hunt for the Wilder People is like this weird little, New Zealand nugget, you know, the little Sam Neill as an old guy
lost in the
woods. Yeah. It's weird to think of Taika Waititi being sort of like on the brink of now like potential Oscar glory. I mean, I reserve judgment because I feel like there wasn't universal acclaim for Jojo Rabbit at the festival.
Do you know what its critical score is on Good Old Rotten Tomatoes?
I haven't dared to look, but I just know like sort of anecdotally there was kind of a semi-mixed reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on the other hand, there was almost, I don't want to say near universal negative reaction to Green Book, but, you know, audience sort of favor alone is sometimes not enough to push you over that last hump to Best Picture glory.
Yeah. He's already gotten a lot of buzz, but through blockbusters. And sometimes
Taika
the
Waititi,
Academy is not a huge fan of that. giving at least major awards to blockbuster-centric directors like him. Nowadays, obviously back in the day, like Spielberg and stuff, obviously getting Oscars, but...
Star Wars got a Best Picture.
Yeah, yeah.
But, can you imagine?
Even if that's the case and they look at it that way, it'll get still, I think, maybe some, you know, sound design or costume design or something smaller like that.
Yeah, it's also the possibility that there could be Scarlett Johansson nomination for either for this or for Marriage Story, which is Marriage Story, I think, was one of the second runner up, and Bong Joon-ho's Parasite was the third runner up for best for People's for the People's Choice Award. Just to put it in context, like past winners for the People's Choice Award have been Green Book.
Yep.
12 Years a Slave, King's Speech.
Okay, yeah.
Slumdog Millionaire.
So every single one of those has won an Oscar.
Yeah, American Beauty, and even back to Chariots of Fire was the People's Choice. And then here are People's Choice nominees, or People's Choice Awards winners that went on to get nominations. So like Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, La La Land, Room, Intimidation Game, The Silver Linings Playbook, Precious, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Life is Beautiful, and The Big Chill.
And all of the... Oh, I don't know about The Big Chill. That was before my times. But all of those won major awards.
Well, yeah, The Big Chill was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, Oh, I meant that. People got to watch that. I think it's not well remembered. But yeah, you gotta watch that.
They insulted it in...
Jeff Goldblum in that is just outstanding.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of great actors in it, but...
Yeah. I know, but I'm trying to get, current people to watch it. So he's the biggest one, right?
Right. No, it's nobody's watching anything for Kevin Kline. but no, it's pretty thoroughly mocked in High Fidelity.
Yeah.
When like, they're making top five lists of like funeral songs, and one of them names one of the song, and the other guy says, no, there's an automatic disqualification because it's in the Big Chill soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Moving on. What I find interesting is that, and maybe you have some opinion on this, is that there was a lot of talk before the festival, and we talk a lot on this show about how TIFF was making...
Oh, I just agreed with you. Yeah, there was a ton. Ton of that talk about TIFF.
Thank you. That it was about, more women directors... people of color in the director's chair and giving more of a spotlight to that. And I feel like once the festival started, people kind of forgot all that.
Yeah.
And it became about who's on the red carpet and what's going to get Oscar buzz. I feel like...
Because I totally forgot Scarlett Johansson was in the film until you mentioned it. So yeah, there hasn't been enough of a female focus after it started.
No, it's... I guess that's kind of what TIFF coverage is all about, which is one of the reasons I got really bored with TIFF coverage back in the days when I was sort of doing more more movie journalism. I hate the red carpet so much. But, yeah, it just seems like this was a really great opportunity to highlight the – because that was sort of the intent of TIFF was to highlight, more women directors, more people of color, and that was also an opportunity to invite the audience as well to sort of recognize these things.
Yeah,
but that's not how it turned out.
Their intent wasn't just for politeness or anything, right? Like there has been a rise in female roles and black films in characters like Black Panther and such, being focused on, but making bank and such.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, it's too bad it didn't. The viewing of TIFF didn't kind of live up to that.
Right. It just felt like it was more of like the pre-festival talk rather than what people were talking about during the festival. And because it even still came down to things like, oh, the Goldfinch disappointed and Lucy in the Sky disappointed. And
yeah, the Goldfinch. You can't. This was our review option was Goldfinch. You didn't watch. So,
I did not want to watch a sad bastard movie about like a stolen painting.
Yeah. But
I'm glad that we went with Hustlers, though, because Hustlers opened number two. Not that everything's about box office, that's what we'll get to later, but Hustlers opened number two, while Goldfinch opened behind It Chapter Two, Hustlers, The Good Boys, Angel Has Fallen, The Lion King, and something called The Overcomer,
Yeah, which, I don't know. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. So that's, you know, where the goldfish set.
And again, it's one of the ones where the main focus was main female characters. So that's just, that's right. Too bad.
Well, it was also, I'm not sure Nicole Kidman is one of the main characters in that, but I mean, that was also
she is, and Natalie Portman was in another one.
Natalie Portman, yeah. Natalie Portman is a star of Lucy in the Sky.
And that did do so well either.
And Noah Hawley is the director of that, the guy who did, what did he do? The Fargo series. The Fargo series on FX.
So I guess this is more of an optimistic view of, well, not optimistic, but maybe instead of us losing the focus, it was just unfortunately some of the more main character female ones weren't, like, didn't get great reviews, you know?
I mean, that's always a possibility.
Yeah.
You know, it's.
Even if that's the case, it's unfortunate there wasn't more effort, you know, put into them.
Well, there wasn't more effort put into the coverage either. I think it all sort of disappeared behind one of the next things we're talking about, which is Joker, which came out of the Venice Film Festival with a lot of pre-release buzz. That seemed to be tempered somewhat by Toronto. That there was a lot of mixed reviews coming out of Toronto.
Oh yeah, it's not in that 80 zone anymore on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's like 77 or something.
I'm glad you brought that up because there's already controversy around that, because there's a BBC reporter, BBC reviewer named Nicholas Barber, who somebody took a screenshot of his reviews, and it's like 3 out of 5, and it was 3 out of 5 for Joker, 3 out of 5 for Avengers Endgame, and 3 out of 5 for Spider-Man Far From Home. And the Avengers and Spider-Man movie had the Fresh logo next to it, and the Joker had the Rotten logo next to it, and someone on Twitter's like, conspiracy! It's a conspiracy against DC!
No, because this is not even that connected to DC.
No, it's very tacit. I think
a lot of it has just been around that, yes, Joaquin Phoenix is phenomenal as the Joker, but everything that kind of revolves around that isn't done perfectly.
Mm-hmm,
you know, but I think it kind of makes me realize maybe there's a reason they don't show much of the other actors in the trailers. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But I like to think, I really like Marc Maron. I like to think he'll do a good role. But I could see how it disappointed people just being kind of more maybe also, it's Todd Phillips, I love him, but more of a just kind of basic plot line, you know? Maybe, I think there's probably a lot of critics that were disappointed it was too much like some other DC films. They're not even more
it could be, but there's also like the criticism about the messages it's sending. Like, there's a lot of talk about where this sort of falls on the culture when we're talking about.
Oh, well, that's, I don't agree on that.
Well,
he's the Joker. He's supposed to be a wild and crazy guy.
But of course, you know, when you talk about the Joker in like full-blown Batman movies where he's a character and he doesn't really have much of an inner life beyond just being a supervillain. This movie takes time to, so from the sound of it, because I haven't seen it, that it takes time to paint this delicate picture of this like sort of lost soul who's been trampled by the meanie bobinis of society, which is of course, you know, what a lot of these like lone wolf aggravated loners thing, whether we're talking about incels or whether we're talking about, you know, active shooters, you know, who feel like, you know, society has ground them underfoot and that they're justified in doing the horrible things that they do, which is kind of what the Joker sounds like it's about. I mean, you kind of have to reserve judgment for the finished movie, but I think there will be a lot of interesting conversations revolving around that, at least.
Yeah.
If the movie holds up to the reviews of, in the points of view of the people who found it very engaging.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
But what
I just don't know.
Right. The other thing that
I think,
yeah,
does there always have to be like a point they're getting across? Like, can it not just be like a heck of a lot of fun, like Machete or something like that? You know, it's the Joker. So here's the thing. It's the Joker. It's Joaquin Phoenix. There needs to be more depth to it. But does the depth need to lead to someone you can like or something? Or I think as long as it makes us sort of understand why the Joker went in that direction, then I'm cool with that.
Or at least in the context of this movie.
There doesn't need to be like a finale message about like, don't be this, you know?
Right. I think
I think it'll just be an interesting look into why some people like go crazy, especially in this current world right now with
right.
A wide population and, you know, harder jobs to get into and social media, more bullying and stuff like that.
Right.
And you can look at it as, oh, so it's good he became like that. No, it should be more akin to viewing it like
Taxi Driver.
Yeah, like Taxi Driver.
Which is one of the influences, right? I think that people have – there's this push-pull because I think there's a certain amount of intellectualizing about what the movie could mean because it's not a Batman movie. It's a movie where it's like using the character, you know, kind of like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, mm-hmm. you know, where it's like we're using this side character to – that people know and to tell a very different story from a different point of view. But at the same time, I've seen these articles pop up. It's like, will Joaquin Phoenix's Joker face off against Robert Pattinson's Batman? Yeah. It's like, why are you even asking this question? Because I don't think that was the intent of Todd Phillips. I don't think that was the intent. And, you know, I've heard interviews with Todd Phillips. He's like, do you have any idea how hard this movie was? Because I have a studio that's saying, well, do we really want like an ultra-violent, realistic depiction of a guy that we sell on kids' pajamas?
Yeah. I'll tell you one thing. It's definitely going to be better than some other villain-centric ones. Like, I love Halle Berry, but it's guaranteed going to be better than Catwoman, right?
That's a super low bar. That's like you might as well not put that bar on the pegs. That's how low that bar is.
Yes, I was young when I saw it, so yeah, my viewership of my viewing of it was very subjective.
But I mean, there's like. When you think about Logan, too, Logan was incredibly successful.
Yeah.
Academy Award nominated. And I mean, Wolverine's on a lot of pajamas, too.
Yeah. But those films, not Catwoman, Logan also had so many phenomenal supporting actors.
Yeah.
So, again, like I said, that's my worry for the Joker.
That's true. I mean,
yeah. And worst come to worst, like people, they could just put a message out on the posters like, this shows. This teaches the lesson. Don't be like this. You know, tell people you're feeling bad. Don't end up being like a crazy serial killer.
Right. And I mean, that again, that could be.
They shouldn't have to shove that message in the face.
Don't be a crazy serial killer, solid message. But no, I mean, it could be the case that very much is Todd Phillips' message. It's just like in maybe it's a fact of any culture that, you know, there's a danger of people misreading. And it's just easier in this culture that it's easier to find people who can rally around the wrong message of a film, like, you know, something like, you know, how Trenchcoat Mafia and how they took that from The Matrix, and you know, the Clee Bolton Harris, you know, included that plus, you know, Manson plus Doom and turned that into a school shooting. It's, I mean,
and giving more of a human look on a evil person. It also just gives the message the world's not black and white.
Yes.
And I think especially right now, because of politics and things, that needs to be spread about even more.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and just try and lighten the mood. Jeez, that went serious. Anyway, we're going to talk about some other stuff, plus our review of Hustlers coming up in the next few minutes. You're listening to CFRU. Was a little Janet Jackson from Rhythm Nation, and it has a pertinent connection to this week's review, so we're not just playing, you know, 80s Janet for no reason. Not that we shouldn't feel guilty about not playing or playing Janet Jackson, because she didn't do anything. Moving on. So Netflix, it is the streaming giant. It is the one who invented binge watching. Mm-hmm. But it seems like Disney is going to uninvented, or at least try it a different path.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I have no idea how I feel about that. That's just... I don't know. What were you going to say about it? What are your thoughts?
Well, I was just going to add that it sounds like when Disney Plus launches in November, all the original series are not going to be launched. Like every episode available at once. They're going to do it week to week, like good old-fashioned TV. So if you were hoping to, get the one-month free trial so you can binge watch The Mandalorian, the new Star Wars show, you are SOL. You're going to have to buy Disney Plus for at least a couple of months to see every episode.
I'm glad they're not doing that with like old Disney things. That would be horrendous. Like Lizzie McGuire or something. Wouldn't be able to binge that. I don't know. Did Disney start this? Netflix has already been doing this. They've been doing it with channels like CW that they're connected with, and Adult Swim, Tyson's Mysteries.
Right, because those shows, like if you watch Riverdale on Netflix, it's on a broadcast network in the United States, so that still comes out week to week, so which is why you get Riverdale once a week and stuff.
Doing it with originals is very different.
Well, they aren't doing it with originals. They're
going to start shows, competition.
British Baking Show and Rhythm and Flow are going to be week to week releases.
See, here's the thing. I myself am very okay with it. I am hyped right now that TV season's coming up, right? Mm-hmm. I love every day like something new, something like I can look forward to instead of just binging it all in one day, right? It's just spread out like months of just TV love and excitement and more thought processing before the next episode. So I as an individual, am very okay with that. When it comes to seniors, though, I feel bad because they only have a certain amount of life left, right? Like there's on Netflix and stuff, especially that baking one, that bothers me because that is an older age average of viewership, right?
They should be able to binge it all before they die.
Well, I'm just saying, they should.
Fair enough. Not a point of view I was expecting today, but...
I could also say like students and stuff, so much homework, right? You don't have time for... you don't have time to wait, and watch it like every week. You can, binge it and then do your schoolwork, but you can't, watch all these shows when you need to on the day they come out. But mainly, no, right. I stand by the senior thing, I think. They need binge-worthy stuff.
Yeah, I do agree, like, the whole time and day thing is kind of over. Mm. But I'm kind of glad that... even in the midst of all this, there's an appreciation of sort of the experience of watching TV. Because one of the things I think gets lost, and Netflix does this, because Netflix has designed a lot of their shows to be quote-unquote bingeable.
Yeah.
And then when you do something like the second season of Stranger Things, where there's like an episode that takes place like outside of the main story off to the side.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's like, I think it's like the seventh episode of season two, and Eleven goes looking for like other kids like her and finds like I can't remember where she ends up, but it's like she's outside of the town the series takes place in, and she's like in a bigger city and she finds someone who is like another government experiment like her. And people hated that episode. I do like the side stories too, because that's one of the things that like Frank Darabont wanted to do when he was designing the Walking Dead TV show, is that the original season two premiere of The Walking Dead was going to be this whole side story about Sam Witwer as like an army guy. Because if you go back to the pilot of The Walking Dead, Rick Grimes gets into a tank, and then he's right next to the dead body of Sam Witwer. And so season two of The Walking Dead was supposed to be like, how did Sam Witwer end up dead in the tank?
Yeah.
And if that was the beginning of the process where Darabont was fired, and that's sparked off like a legal proceeding that I think is still going on, at least in terms of appeals. But I mean, yeah, that's something that binge TV misses. It's like the ability to go to the side, that it doesn't you don't have to barrel through story,
yes.
And you don't have to build up to like the next. I mean, it's almost gone backwards to the days of the old shorts where you have to leave them on a cliffhanger and you have to come back the next week. Although it's like come back the next minute.
It'll lead to way more like back in the old day family viewing too. When it comes out like the one day, the family will be able to sit down together instead of their 10-year-old son or whatever being able to binge all the Mandalorian. you can do that sort of thing. It could be like, you know, back in the old days, like, you know, watch a nice little TV show episode, new episode with your parents while eating dinner, and just it'll enhance and rise a lot of family viewing together, I think.
There's something nice about sort of like just taking an hour. Mm-hmm. And then getting like the complete, even if it's like sort of like a continuation thing, if it's like a, you know, like a more, you know, expansive narrative, like say Game of Thrones or something, isn't it? Take an hour. The show starts at this hour. Even if you're just starting it at whatever random time you want, and then that, like an hour later, it's over and you can go do something else.
Yeah. You don't have an episode after, so you have to pay more attention.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you have to sort like sit down and watch.
Yeah, so no, I'm very okay with it. I could see the faults, but I think overall it's quite nice they're doing it. And especially because all the old Disney ones, you're going to be able to binge.
Well, I mean, it's also, I think it's also very tricky of them too, because I think there was somebody I saw on social media who said, because there's so many streaming sites now, it's like, what I'm going to do is like, I'm going to sign up for two streaming services for a couple of months and then watch everything I want to watch and then cancel them and then choose two other streaming services, watch whatever, and then kind of like run them in rotation like this. And what it speaks to is like a problem that I think all these streaming services are going to have is that, you know, is there enough business or is there enough customers that people are going to want to subscribe to enough of all these services? And then what happens if that business model collapses? I don't think Disney Plus will collapse by any stretch of the imagination, but something like
Hulu.
Hulu. I mean, Disney owns 40% of Hulu, so
do they? Okay,
so Disney can come out and say like, "Well, like we got our own thing. Like we're losing money on this. We're going to invest in our own name brand one instead." But I mean, it's happened. Like Show Me in Canada here. There's no Show Me anymore. You can't subscribe to Show Me anymore.
Yeah, I think that was more what Crave TV that kind of helped kill it off. Or
I don't.
But yeah,
I don't know. I think because Canada is such a small market, it couldn't handle all those.
I don't worry about Netflix or Hulu, like we said. I do worry about smaller ones, like what you just mentioned, and that horror one that you use,
Shudder,
ones like that.
But I mean, Shudder's also, I think,
Criterion.
I think the Shudder you get in Canada here is more or less the same as the Shudder you get in other places. And I think that's the same for Criterion too, because they both kind of own their own content. I mean, I'm not worried about those, but I mean, something like in the States, like Apple Plus.
Oh, yeah. I'm worried about it. HBO Max. Take off at all.
Yeah. It's, you know, they've invested a lot in like big name talent, like Jennifer Aniston.
Ooh,
and
yeah, I'm excited.
J.J. Abrams and M. Night Shyamalan.
Jeff Goldblum. It's true. Yeah.
Well, Jeff Goldblum makes box office. And speaking of making box office, James Cameron was doing an interview where he, in a surprising move, said that he is happy that Avengers Endgame stole the box office crown from Avatar, because at least it means that people are still going out to the movie theater. I would note that Endgame, like, basically made a little less than $1 million worldwide than Avatar. So it's like a photo finish.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, it's, Avatar was also the number one movie domestically, but I mean, Star Wars Force Awakens surpassed that years ago. But
still, yeah, no, universally it's,
yeah,
it's
so,
now second.
He thinks this bodes well maybe for Avatar 2 and 3 and 4 and 5.
I don't know about that. He also, even though he said all those positive words, he said it in a way that he seemed a little bummed or a little mad. You could tell that he's fuming to get back to number one. I don't know. I guess Avatar 2 and 3 have potential for that. My only concern is they're going to come out over a decade after the first one. Mm-hmm. They're going to be any kids that have interest in it. Endgame, it's kids. It's all kids going and bringing their parents. And then obviously, you know, like some adults. A ton of adults too, but mainly kids and the adults that have those kids. And I don't know if it's going to work like that with Avatar. You know, there might be some parent lovers that like force their kids to go, but there's not going to be any kids who are craving to go see some film they never watched, right? And if kids like watched Avatar right now, it's dated. The CGI is dated. So it's,
yeah,
I think
I mentioned this last week. I bought it on Blu-ray at The Beat Goes On over the summer, and I haven't put it on yet. I do wonder, because Avatar feels like such a fluke to me.
It did. I was surprised that it made as much as it did. It's just because it was a new invention.
Well, not just that, but I mean, it's...
Well, these two will have some new
It's debatable that it's a new invention because it's very much like, you know, Pocahontas in space, but...
Yeah.
Or Ferngully, the last rainforest in space, but it just seemed like the point of it was to show off the mocap.
Yeah.
And the 3D, and it's like sort of what The Hobbit was. Like, it was an exercise, and look how cool the technology is, look how advanced our technology is.
Yeah, and just the artistic and look at the Tolkien world.
It sort of feels a little heartless.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it could very well... I think people did pick up on this is a visual splendor that it has to be seen on the big screen.
And it's another step forward, right? Yeah. Like, he did make the underwater camera and vehicle inventions just to make this. Well, to do that touch the bottom thing, but then also even more so to make this, because the second one apparently will be underwater.
Uh-huh.
So it'll get some attention for that.
It's just so ambitious. And like,
yeah, it's going to make bank. I unfortunately don't think it'll make over Endgame.
No, I mean it's again playing in that level feels so weird, and it just speaks to sort of where the movie business is now, where it's more about how much you can make in one go instead of how much you can make with like five or six like smaller films. It's about like sort of maximizing that one film to get it to like $3.5 billion or however much, instead of saying like, here we have this movie we made for $30 or $40 million and it made $200 million. Isn't that nice? You know, it's
Maybe his plan is Avatar 2, super successful, does well, right? Mm-hmm. Like maybe makes like $1 billion. And then all that buzz, and it's just 2 years later, Avatar 3 gets out. Maybe it makes the bank and beats out Endgame. Maybe. I don't know. At the same time, James Cameron, he's smart when it comes to making that moolah, so he might have some plans afoot.
He's smart for sure, and I think he
was somehow able to make Alita Battle Angel overpass its budget by actually like a surprising decent amount because of overseas stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a terrible movie either.
Oh, no, I loved it. I just mean, yeah, like he was able to somehow make it way more money than people expected. Still not enough, but more than expected.
Yeah, it's I think he maybe understands his audience or the audience maybe a bit better than we do. I can't imagine going to the Sunday afternoon showing of Avatar 2 and it's going to be and I'm going to have to sit in the front row because it's full, like I did on Avengers Endgame.
And that's, yeah, I don't think that'll be the case.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to leave that there and talk about what we all came here to see: hardcore nudity. Actually, there wasn't any hardcore nudity in Hustlers. That was just a Troy McClure line I wanted to use. Anyway, we're going to kick off our review next after Little Northumberland Slums and Innes Wilson. And then we will get in touch with J-Lo, Constance, and the whole gang in Hustlers. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Kippus, and Community Radio. Just to see a moon, I know inside your heart you are true. Yes, I'll be gone for days and days, but my heart can't get away, 'cause inside I am true. 'Cause there ain't no other girl in this world that compares to you. No other girl that could give me these lover's blues.
I was a centerfold once.
No way.
93.
No way.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
Back when Stevie Wonder came in.
What the Stevie Wonder coming to Club 4?
Casey had him in the champagne room. Swears to God he isn't blind.
Wow. How come you're so good? I see you with every single kind of guy, and I don't know, it's like you have them all figured out.
I guess I'm just a people person.
And that was a clip from Hustlers. It is the new film from Lorraine Scarfia, and it stars Constance Wu, Jennifer Lopez, Julia Stiles, Kiki Palmer, Lily Reinhart, Cardi B, and Mercedes Rule. Academy Award winner Mercedes Rule. Do you know what she won for?
No, what?
Fisher King. In
oh, wow.
Yeah, so she's...
Good on her.
She's needed a comeback for a while. So, Hustlers is based on a true story. It was it was a magazine article about exotic dancers who, after the economic slump, shall we say, the crash in 2008, found themselves in need of money, and so they started ripping off the people who used to come in nightly at this strip club and drop tens of thousands of dollars in a night.
They did what Cardi B did. Yes. In real life, which I find very interesting.
Right. Although Cardi B's not part of the gang. And
yes, no, I know. I found that very interesting, too.
But maybe she had some sort of technical consultant role, maybe.
Well, she's also, yeah, it was just a kind of pop in, pop out.
Yeah. What I find interesting about this movie, and it's been said many times, many ways, really great showcase for Jennifer Lopez.
Oh, Jennifer Lopez was outstanding. Yeah. She was such a lovable action hero in this. Well, I don't know, I don't know if hero's the right. You know what? No. She was a hero to the stripper community. So, yeah. No, she was phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah, she owns like the minute the first time you see her is when she comes out on stage to do a performance and it's to a Fiona Apple song.
Yep.
And like, there's no, she's obviously in lingerie, but like, there's no real nudity involved. But I mean, just like the performance and the athleticism.
Yeah.
And
it was phenomenal dancing.
It's, yeah, she was, yeah. I mean, she comes
I'm not
from a
into
dancing
that,
background.
That kind of thing, but it was just, it was objectively great choreography and dancing.
Yes. Like it's just so, she's just so magnetic from that moment. And then the very next scene, you see her. She's like sitting on the roof having a cigarette.
Yeah.
And she's just like resplendent. She's like just lounging back. She's wearing this incredibly elaborate fur coat that looks like something out of Louis the 15th.
She's used to that world and she knows what she's doing. Right? That's why she's the guide and the leader of everyone else.
It's just so like,
yeah.
You're just drawn to her from the very start.
Yeah, no, especially in like a Guelph or some small town, you know, you think of just strip dancers being, you know, like just someone doing it quickly to get some money or something like that, right? But like there's professionals and they can make a good amount of moolah and they can be really intelligent people like J-Lo and
good business people.
Very fiscally wise.
I mean here in Guelph the only adult entertainment facility we have is like literally sandwiched between a highway and a dead end road.
Yeah,
so it's you know, don't go by the manor is sort of like you know, what you think of exotic dancing. But
I only hear about that, right? So it was nice to get an actual more, I don't know about more real, but a good, just a good look at it.
Right.
One that wasn't viewing them in a bad way.
It's not exploitative at all.
Yeah.
It's,
there's no nudity or anything. It was honestly
it's not
oh, there's
tacky.
An extra.
Like, it's not Showgirls or what was that Demi Moore one?
Yeah, like J-Lo and Constance Wu and none of the main characters are.
Right. It's, I want to say it's tasteful.
Oh, it's very tasteful.
But yeah, it isn't treating the business as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, these were women who were depending on, you know, earning their living. And it makes very clear at the beginning of the movie that, you know, there are sleazy characters here too.
Because that's another unfortunate real part about it.
Right. And you see this, you see Constance Wu after, I think it's supposed to be her first day. And, you know, she's made, you know, however much money she's made, but she's got to pay the manager.
Yeah.
She's got to pay the doorman. And, you know, these women are the ones who are sort of on stage and having to perform and having to, you know, deal with all these handsy guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, but at the end of the night, they're having to cough up, you know, $10, $20, $50 to all the other people in the club too. And, you know, it's almost like the people running the club are as exploitative as the people who engage in the club. And
because that's true.
Yeah.
They get scammed. They don't get nearly paid enough.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was unfair in that place, you know, like the manor and like, you know, smaller place, like, oh,
it's very, very unfair. It's tougher for sure. I think the movie Hustlers, I think it fits in very well with, there have been a lot of films that sort of deal with the economic downturn, with the Great Recession. I'm thinking about Margin Call and The Big Short. This is probably more like 99 Homes, where it's like, how did this affect, like, directly affect sort of people on the ground?
Yeah, and just regular people. The Big Short, it's more how it affected, you know, the richy rich, the people who, you know, contributed it to it starting.
Right.
At least according to Cardi B's character, one of the characters really makes that comment in this film.
Right.
It was a look at just like the regular people and what we had to deal with back then, you know?
Right. It's very, you know, the Big Short and Margin Call 2 are like very much Anatomy of a Disaster kind of movies, whereas like 99 Homes and this are like, this is how it, as you said, affects the people on the ground. And, you know, what happens when, like, the money just goes away and you're the one left holding while, you know, sort of everyone else gets to move on. And what I think the movie does very shrewdly is it doesn't set up the women like they're Robin Hoods. They're not like heroes necessarily.
No,
they're doing what they have to survive. And yeah, you may not necessarily feel bad for some of these people, but the other hand is that the women themselves end up getting caught in sort of like the same behaviors that the people they're fleecing did. And at the end too, and this isn't necessarily a spoiler because it's, you know, again, based on sort of true events.
Yeah, there's not really any spoilers.
But the Constance Wu and the J-Lo characters, Destiny and Ramona, kind of get away with like a slap on the wrist, even though they're kind of the organizers of this.
Yeah.
While the two sort of lesser people who are part of like the main gang, the characters played by Lily Reinhart and Kiki Palmer, end up doing jail on the weekends.
Yeah.
And it's like,
so still a really short time.
So right, but there's still this hierarchy that like the people in charge managed to squeak by, but the people who were the grunts end up like it ends up falling on them to do the hard time.
Yeah. No, it was just a phenomenal look at how people in, you know, those 2000s, like 2011 to I think 15, dealt with their fiscal issue, and sometimes it had to be something not so nice, but because of what was happening, it was something I could still relate to. They weren't doing something good, but I could see why they felt like they had to.
Mm-hmm.
And all around, just great acting. Mm-hmm. A phenomenal performance by J-Lo, Constance Wu, Kiki Palmer, Lily Reinhart. They were the main four. The last two I said, there wasn't really like much screen time with them, but that's
right,
because it very centered around J-Lo and her being the one to help Constance Wu find the same path and help her deal with What was the specific name of that economic downfall?
The Great, well, you can call
Great
it
Depression.
Most people call it
the
Great Recession.
Yeah, Great Recession.
Because it wasn't quite depression. It wasn't depressed enough to be a depression.
I'll tell you what, it also had that fun music from that era. The music in this was outstanding. And
I'm glad
we already talked
about
the choreography, but whoever did the sound editing like matched it perfectly to that dancing.
Yeah, they use a lot of vintage Janet and not necessarily the...
Not just all pop ones. They played some soul acts. So
it would
be like 2000-y kind of, you know, or sorry, like early 2010 hipsters and stuff. You know, you'd know that jam, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And some early Flo Rida. I found that interesting. David Guetta.
Yeah. No, and there were not just that, but like they have this like, there's scenes like where they go to like the uppity crust stores and they're like shopping with their newfound spoils, and it happens a couple times in the film, but the music they play is like this kind of like those discs you used to be able to get at like Walmart where it's like Chopin for beginners, and you know, it's kind of like your introduction to Chopin, where it's like these like very like tight little piano ditties where it's
the writers were definitely very present in the fun scenes of this economic downturn
right
in this era.
Yeah, the music choices are amazing.
Yeah.
It just, you know, everything sort of sings. It adds this little heightened bit to the action, and it's very noticeable when there is no... Actually, I wouldn't even say that, too, because one of the most tense sequences, like when the police come and actually pick them up, is it's set to the tune of that Lorde song.
Yeah.
And
Royals, I think? One of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we've heard too much of her since then. I think she's kind of a one-hit wonder, unfortunately. But it's a really great example of, as you said, matching music to scene and music editing and how, like, a valuable... a skill that is, rather than just like plopping in a song, because I feel like sometimes movies have that feeling. It's like, we'll just plug in a song, like Suicide Squad is like that.
I almost had a kind of Baby Driver vibe while I was watching it.
Baby Driver,
it connected very, very much so to the plot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they blast an Usher song, and Usher does appear in the club.
And it's love in
this
club.
Does he make love in the club?
When he comes in the club.
Well, you have to watch the film to find out.
He was certainly being loved in the club.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's I did enjoy that. I wonder if, you know, Usher was one of these guys who was
he was, the 2000s were for him. He was a king of the 2000s.
Right, like early, like late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
Because I remember when he was like in The Faculty.
Yeah.
Like he was the next sort of crossover guy. And it makes me wonder, you know, speaking of cultural relevance from the Avatar discussion, it's like, is Usher going to be more remembered for being Usher or for like having a cameo in Hustlers?
I think he'll be remembered. Because I'll tell you what, he was like... Jay Biebs wouldn't be around without him, right?
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. So I think he's been doing a lot more behind the scenes stuff.
Fair enough.
Also, it would surprise me if he's like kind of like pulling kind of what T.I. does and stuff, like just kind of briefly featuring in a lot of TV shows and stuff. You know, maybe Ballers or something. I don't know.
Ballers.
Some show I don't watch.
There was a reference I wasn't prepared for today.
But no, he's going to, he'll be remembered very much so for his 2000s. What he gave us in the 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Yeah. We've talked just a ton of positives. Any negatives you can think of? I know, it was enjoyable.
There's some drag, I think.
Drag, really?
I think
there's like 90 minutes pretty much.
No, it's very tight, but I think there is a bit of drag here and there. I think there's a bit of drag when... you know, when like the good days, like after like they've started sort of ripping people off and, you know, they're getting good and they're expanding and it's like one big happy family. And, you know that it's all going to go to pot.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of a matter of like, when does it happen? And it feels like the good times are like really, really good. And then all of a sudden we kind of hit the skids. And it's never also really kind of properly explained what Julia Stiles's reporter is like. I mean, obviously,
she's the writer of the
book. The writer of the article, but it's sort of in the context of the movie. I'm not sure how framing it, like as the interview with Constance Wu, like
that framing was maybe a bit wonky.
The framing was wonky. I think the movie would have benefited a bit more if it just been like straight. Just if it's just like
biopic.
Yeah, like Constance Wu starts at the club. She meets J-Lo, and then we carry on, and you know. It also ends sadly without the Constance Wu and J-Lo characters kind of resolving things.
But the it's suggested that they do hang out again. So I think it kind of gives your imagination.
But I mean,
I'm okay with that.
As you said, though, the movie is so much about, it's not so much about the gang, it's about these two women.
Yeah. Well, because there's even a comment made about how Constance Wu's character, Dorothy, is she's that kind of person. She was neglected as a kid. She needs a friend.
And I felt that was kind of introduced a bit too late, like sort of like the psychological stuff.
I thought it was pretty noticeable from the beginning. But yeah, I guess if they were going to do it that way, they should have just kept it.
They treated it like it's a big reveal, as opposed to something that's sort of driving
her. It should have just
stayed
visibly around, but not like actually verbably stated.
Right, because
that made it more like a sitcom or something, where you have to literally word for word say the message.
Right, because in a very different light, this is sort of a love story, where you know you have sort of these two lost souls who find something in each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting and very compelling story about female friendship, but it is also a love story. It is about two people who complete each other.
Yeah.
Ramona very much needs someone to sort of guide. It needs to be a protector. There's like a mama bear aspect to her.
Yeah.
And Constance Wu needs someone to be protect her.
Well, and see, Kate, there needs to be a name for female starring films mm-hmm. that are like that. Because the guy ones, like Without a Paddle and stuff, we got bromances. We can call it that, right?
Yeah.
There might be, but I wish there was a more used term for ones like Hustlers that are like that. But for, you know, J-Lo and Constance Wu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Also, I wish... okay, Constance Wu's grandma.
Yeah. Nana.
I would have been maybe okay if she was in it more, so there was more of a care for her. And what, you know,
I would have liked it more if, like, Nana had sort of been curious about why her daughter was, like, bringing home bricks.
Yeah, it was kind of weird, especially because J-Lo just didn't hide pretty much what the job was.
Right, because, like, was it, like, did Nana know she was an exotic dancer?
I don't know. You don't find that out.
Because I do like the scene where she's talking about they're having, like, Christmas dinner together.
Yes,
and Nana's talking about, like, Frankie Valli.
Frankie Valli. We got them there.
We did get some Frankie Valli.
Yeah.
This is a very eclectic soundtrack that you would never have guessed in a million years.
Somehow. I'm already excited for when it comes out on Apple Music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll chart. I think it'll be like that Braid film where it'll chart. It'll do really well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's...
And they also could have the grandma thing. I'm viewing that as a negative, her not being in it enough,
mm-hmm.
but they could have been doing that on purpose to send the message like, strippers, they're busy. They don't have time for that.
Sure.
She didn't have time for her grandma.
Well, it said right up that, you know, one of the dancers talks about how, like, guys will always want to date a stripper, but, you know, you work 6 days a week. It's, you know, they go in at 5 and they're done at, like, 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
It's not exactly an ideal sort of lifestyle.
So they could have been totally doing that on purpose, and it actually would make sense. So.
It could. But I think, like, these are very, very slight grumbles.
Yeah.
Very slight.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the movie from beginning to end.
I enjoyed it, yeah, very much so.
Yeah. It's very good.
Yeah.
So check out Hustlers.
Yeah.
It's in theaters now. And that is it for the show, I'm afraid. All the good things must come to an end. And you can find this show again if you liked it and you want to listen to it again. Find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Peter... I already know, but tell everyone else where they can find you.
You can find me and my media bros as Mr. Taurak on YouTube and Twitter. Mr. Taurak's YouTube, our OCAD brethren, who's a member, has released a new video, and
ooh.
I helped film it.
Oh, very good.
And credits podcaster helped film this, so you got to check it out. Mr. Taurak, YouTube, Twitter. All right.
So we don't just talk about... movies we sometimes make.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
You better believe it.
I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for election coverage on Open Source's Guelph. We are starting our candidate interviews tomorrow, and you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.ca for other political stuff. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.